Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, thanks for the breathing room with the extended end of the year break. Now the show is back and better than ever. Speaking of better, I've decided to start banking episodes so that we have more time to make transcripts, edit the show properly, and prep as much as possible. The cost of this new plan is that sometimes the show will get a little out of date. So our conversation today about Kevin McCarthy's speaker election obviously ended up getting settled, but the underlying dynamics are going to continue throughout the year. My guest today is Bradley Tusk, making his return appearance on The Realignment. Bradley has worn a lot of hats. He's a venture capitalist at Tusk Venture Partners, where he invests in early stage startups in highly regulated industries. He was the deputy governor of Illinois, ran Mike Bloomberg's 2009 mayoral campaign, played a huge role in Uber's strategy to break into cities, and was the comms director for Senator Chuck Schumer, who is now the Senate Majority Leader. Because of Bradley's wealth of experiences, we're going to kick the year off with his analysis of how Republicans are going to proceed throughout the rest of the year, where the tech industry is going, his longstanding mobile voting idea slash case, and his predictions for 2023 at a broader level. Before we dive in, a couple quick reminders. One, this show is brought to you by our Supercast subscribers. We raised enough from the show last year that we are going to be able to independently run and produce the show moving forward. Obviously, a huge shout out to Lincoln Network, who continues to support the show, but it just means that Lincoln and the Hewlett Foundation's support will go to up-leveling rather than just the foundation, which everyone here has been so helpful to support. Starting this week, we're going to significantly up the amount of subscriber-exclusive content. Huge thanks to everyone who got us here. If you'd like to subscribe, you can go to realignment.supercast.com or click the link at the top of the show notes. Two, the Substack is coming back from its own hiatus this Friday. You can go click the link in the show notes. You can find access to transcripts and all the other added features we're going to continue upping this year. Last but not least, this is a book show. We all love books here, so I want to shout out P&T Knitwear, which is Bradley Tusk's new bookstore in Manhattan. I'm going to definitely check it out when I go back to New York in March. Plus, of course, the Realignments bookshop, which is available in the show notes. All that said, really glad to be back. Hope you enjoy the show. Bradley Tusk, welcome back to the Realignment.
Hey, thanks for having me back on. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really glad to speak with you. Folks will know the show has been on the end of the year hiatus, so this is the perfect conversation to bring things back. I will note we are recording this on Thursday, January 5th, so we're about to speak about the speaker's race, obviously, so I don't want to date this too much, but for everyone's sake, at this point in the conversation, there have been multiple votes. This has gone way further than anyone would have expected. Would love just to hear your reaction before we get into the more meta political aspects around it.
Yeah, I mean, look, of course, I'm sort of loving it in the sense that it's just fascinating. I'm an independent. I like activism. Now that not like either party, I actively dislike both parties. So I kind of enjoy when either of them are in chaos, but it's just fun for me to watch. Also, by the way, if you're a VC, by definition, you kind of like blowing shit up, right? That's sort of that's what you're called to. So like, the chaos is fun for me to watch. Look, I mean, a couple of at least quick thoughts is one, this is in some ways for McCarthy, the price you pay when you believe in nothing, right? Which is the reason why the Freedom Caucus keeps negotiating and renegotiating with him is they know he has no principles. They know he stands for nothing other than his own ambition. And so ultimately, while he doesn't want to agree to provisions that will then make it harder for him to be speaker, he'll always take, you know, the chance of being speaker ahead of anything else or being effective speaker. And so when you're negotiating with someone who believes in nothing, you can just keep pushing them all day long because, you know, there's no real reason to expect them not to. That's number one. Number two is, you know, there are some people in the middle now, kind of House Democrats or moderates, who I think will be very empowered in regardless of how this turns out. You know, some Republican will be speaker. They will always have the Freedom Caucus, right, on anything that's not, you know, far right. And they're always going to need 5, 10, 15 Democratic votes to get anything done. And so the Problem Solvers Caucus, and disclosure, the head of it, Josh Gottheimer, is married to my sister, so a little biased. But nonetheless, The Democrats in the middle who take shit from the AOCs of the world all the time, I think are now going to end up being in many ways the most relevant people in Congress.
A couple things, and I'm glad you set this up in a way that it doesn't really matter whether or not McCarthy becomes speaker. The point is that this event happened. You know, this is unprecedented. It's been a century since this has happened. So no matter who is speaker, when this episode comes out, this is significant. I want to talk about your point about VCs liking chaos, liking things blowing up, because obviously that means a space is disrupted. That means a new entrant, Uber, Airbnb, all the obvious things we've talked about before. I wonder how you think that tracks with politics. When something blows up in the political system, does that, let's say, does that hole, does that open space necessarily get filled by something good? Like, how much does this idea track?
Yeah, so in fairness to VCs, when we blow something up, it's generally with an alternate system company approach in mind that we're trying to. We're coming to the table with a solution, right? Like, I don't go looking for industries that I want to fuck with and then come back and say, let me find a startup who can do it. You know, I meet with a zillion startups a day, like every VC. And when I find ones that I really like, then if I'm like, look, this industry is particularly entrenched, corrupt, you know, lazy. It would be fun to pick them on top of the fact that it's winnable and the right thing to do and a good investment. You know, that's how we've had to come to that conclusion. And the challenge you have in politics is, you know, they theory have solutions that they had, you know, the Green New Deal on the left or whatever crazy shit the Freedom Caucus is supporting. But in reality, they don't have solutions, right? All they want to do is create chaos. And they don't actually want solutions to happen because then they're responsible for actually governing and legislating and getting things done. And they're not capable of doing that. It's like the difference is in politics, the chaos just leads to more chaos a lot of the time, whereas in tech and VC, it generally leads to an outcome of winning or losing, right? We won. We did sort of establish this new approach, this new, you know, way of doing whatever it is, or we lost, right? And the entrenched interests sort of, their power holds. But either way, we kind of get to an outcome. Whereas in politics, it's just indefinite and is in the interest of the people, the radical rousers on the far left and the far right. Keep doing it. You know, if anything shows the need for not even a third party, but it's four parties, right? The best thing that could happen to the system, or one of them, would be if the Freedom Caucus said, screw this, we're starting the Freedom Party, right? And if the DSA type said, screw this, we're starting the, you know, the Socialist Party, or we're in that, then all of a sudden, they're no longer competing in primaries with mainstream Democrats and Republicans. And that gives mainstream Democrats and Republicans a lot more leeway to work with each other, to compromise, to build consensus, because you're not worried about only radical voters from either side of the aisle who are going to participate in your primary. So like this morning, someone said to me, why can't the Democrats just cut a deal for a moderate Republican? I said, they could, and maybe by ballot 43, that's what will happen. But, you know, they're all going to be afraid that if they say, okay, let's make Fred Upton the speaker, whoever it is, that then they're going to primary in the left in 2 years, and they're going to say this person supported a Republican for the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and they're going to have to defend against that, right? And that's the main thing they're worried about is not hurting their chances of reelection. And so the extent that we could bifurcate the parties, that would be great. You know, I've been advising the Forward Party a little bit, and Andrew Yang a little bit, on kind of what they can do. And look, I'm for pretty much every kind of political reform, so happy to help them. But I think in politics, it's much easier to kill stuff than it is to create stuff. And so in some ways, seeing the two parties fracture is probably a higher likelihood than seeing a third party come to life and be real successful.
You know, it's interesting when you're talking about, like, you know, left intransigences and right intransigences, there's been a lot of talk about how, well, you know, when Nancy Pelosi won her final election for the speakers, for this, you know, speakership, you didn't have the squad perform similarly. There are a bunch of, like, theories of the case on why the left and the right ends of the two parties kind of behave differently in Congress. Like, what's your theory of the case here?
Yeah, I don't think it's, I think it's just that it's her, it's not them, right? I think the extremists are extremists on either side of the aisle. And look, the left might not be doing that as much in the House, but they certainly, you see it in city government, you see it in state government. It's not like we don't see that similar type of behavior. We just didn't see it under Pelosi because she was so good at her job that she was able to, through persuasion, coercion, threats, whatever it was, ultimately get, you know, people on board. McCarthy is just not as smart as she is, not as talented as she is. People aren't afraid of him, obviously, right? And so, you know, he just can't perform in the way that she did. But if you had a really weak Democrat who was the leader, now Hakeem, I think, is not weak. I think he's actually very, I know Hakeem for a long time, and I think he's actually very strong, and it was a great choice. But let's just say they had someone, a McCarthy-esque type, on their side, and they took back the House in 2 years or 4 years, I think he'd have the same exact problem.
That's fascinating. Yeah. So making this really a story about, in both cases, this is less about the two like parties and about the specific individuals who found themselves on the precipice of power there. I want to take one other step back. We're going to get into your kind of tech-centric predictions. I want to talk about like the broad narrative around the tech industry right now. Like obviously towards the end of the year, you know, a bunch of things blow up literally and figuratively. You obviously had struggles with Tesla's stock. You have all of the troubles with Twitter's stock. You have social media, both from a, let's say, stock performance level, but also at a like user engagement level kind of crest. It seems as if the period that really bookended your rise and your success in the VC industry, right? This post-iPhone, mobile, social to cloud period is just kind of coming to an end. I'd love for you to say whether or not you kind of agree with that framework, whether this year feels differently than last year, but then also, what do you think occurred during that period if we can bookend it?
Yeah. So look, so I don't know that it's coming to an end, because when you look at all of the sort of analysis of what's happening in VC right now, the economy and everything else, no, other than crypto, which we can discuss separately, no one really says like, oh, it's because this sector got too much power or wasn't powered enough. No one's really talking about specific fields, technologies, industries, with the exception of crypto. You know, so I don't think that's what it is, nor do I think, by the way, like the term Web3 may lose a little bit of salience because people are afraid to say it, but ultimately we're still moving in that direction, right? Like that's still, it may not require, it may or may not include cryptocurrency. I think it will. But either way, blockchain serves a lot of functions and purposes that are still going to be here. So really to me, it's just more of the sort of classic pattern of economic cycles where there are too many VCs and they raise too much money without a really good reason why. So like, I think there are two types of VCs that will sort of weather this just fine and come out ahead. The big institutionals that they're not going anywhere. Look, does Sequoia have a big black eye with FTX? Yes. Is it going to change their ability to stay in business? No, right, at all. Or much smaller funds like us that are truly different, right? You know, we are the only venture fund that I'm aware of that goes out and solves your political problems for you. Runs campaigns to legalize ride sharing or fantasy sports spending or prescription via text or, you know, e-scooters or whatever it is, right? So for us, because our value add is so radically different than everybody else in the sector, I feel really good about where we stand. And we're actually investing at a faster pace right now than we were for the second half of 21 and most of 22. Because valuations are coming down, not a ton, but they're coming down a bit. And it's all founders valuations, but the tenor has changed, right? Okay. So like the heat of it, I get on a call with a founder. In theory, they're pitching me, but then I'm told 20 minutes after the call, you know, submit a term sheet today, you're out. And use my answer, but go fuck yourself. I'm not going to like be bullied into submitting a term sheet. And if other people get it first, because that's what happened, so be it, right? That has changed a lot. All the leverage has shifted back.
So that's not even, it's not even on the table anymore, the presumption.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, either look, the hottest deal ever, maybe, but basically, I think founder, by the way, it's how it should be, which is founders are pitching us and we owe it to our LPs to conduct really extensive diligence, call customers, test the product, come up with every argument answer we possibly can. You know, tear apart their TAM analysis and build our own, whatever you can think of. And then if we still reach the conclusion like, yeah, this is a worthwhile investment, great, that's what we should have met. And then we've got, you know, some percentage chance of that actually then succeeding, right? But I think what you had instead were so many funds didn't have any real reason to exist other than that it was easy to raise money and they had to deploy the capital, right? And so like, they were just throwing to people without much diligence, without anything else. And in some ways, because the incentives became totally perverted, which is, I believe that a lot of funds were raised in reverse, meaning the founders say, 2%, I need this many million dollars a year to run my business and to take home as a salary. That times 50 is X, right? So if I need $20 million, that means I need a $1 billion fund for the 2% annually to meet all of my needs. So I'm going to go out and raise $1 billion. They're not even really thinking about or worrying about the carry, right? They're just thinking about, well, for the next 10 years, I have this guaranteed revenue source. And if I can raise more funds on top of that, it'll just grow and grow and grow. Mm-hmm. And their incentives became totally disaligned with the LP's incentives, right? And as a result, you saw so much money chasing so many bad deals, because if you're a fund like that, let's say you're $800 million Series A and B fund, you know, we write for Series A deals checks that are typically $5 million, mm-hmm. three sometimes, or six. And that's generally, we think, the right way to do it. I have a $600 million Series A fund, I can't write $3 million checks, right? I would have like an endless number of deals. It wouldn't work. I need to write a $15 million check, a $20 million check, which automatically screws up the valuation, makes it way too high. And then the sad part is everyone was in on the joke. So at every successive phase, you had VCs who just said, I got to deploy capital and I don't really care what the valuation is. I just have to get the money out the door, which is why you get to a point where companies in Series G, they finally go public at a $50 billion valuation, and 3 months later, it's at 15. Mm-hmm. Because the capital markets are doing exactly what we should have done in the first place, which was, you know, accurately analyze, you know, how good is this business? What's the PE ratio, PE and everything else? And reprice it. And the reason it got out of control is not because the public market investors didn't know what they're doing. It's because, you know, the incentives on the VC side totally flipped in a way that was just not aligned for the best outcome.
You know, two things come to mind here. And once again, I like speaking with you because you have your VC hat, which just gave us, but now I'm going to ask you to put on your political operator hat. Sure. So you just raised two, let's just say, squirmy circumstances for politicians. So firstly, just crypto, right? So you had Mayor Suarez of Miami go very in on like the crypto branding, like very aggressively, stuff like Citicoin. Sorry, Miami is like the city of like crypto. I'm like this future centric candidate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you had obviously in New York, where you're coming to us from, Mayor Adams, like talked about like getting his salary in Bitcoin, I believe. Yep. So like in both cases, you kind of had politicians leaning into the boom. So can you just like comment about how you think voters receive that in either direction, but then B, like, how would you advise any politician in general handling kind of the, once again, like I'm not anti-crypto, but there's just definitely something a little, I'd say like off-putting about like the financialization, bringing that part in. How would you advise people think about that?
I actually have no problem with what Francis or Eric did. And I'm not sure I would have advised to do anything differently, even knowing what I know today. So your first question is, how does it impact the kind of voters, their political positioning, everything else? It doesn't, right? So this is maybe the most important point I can make in our conversation overall, which is voters go into the voting booth with two or three things in their head, and that's it, right? The party, kind of an overall feel like this guy's a creep or this guy seems nice or whatever it is, and maybe one or two issues, but maybe not it, right? So they're sort of not going in, with the exception of, you know, hardcore Bitcoin maxis who generally don't vote anyway. The people actually voting in primaries, they're not looking at most specific issues, right? There might be one thing that they're obsessed about or mad about or whatever it is or happy about. So one is, it never was going to impact the ultimate outcome of what a voter would do. So what Eric and Francis were both trying to do at its most base political was, A, establish themselves as innovative and future-oriented and exciting. B, because the press likes the cover stuff that's new and innovative, especially crypto, it generated a lot of coverage for them, right? And C, you know, if they do it right, maybe it has some substantive benefit. So Miami, I think, did benefit quite a bit because a lot of startups moved down there. We incubated a startup down there. A lot of people have. A lot of funds moved down there. And so I think, regardless of Miami Citicoin, you know, Suarez actually did a pretty decent job in taking a tech sector that was pretty dead in Miami and turning it into something. And if he used crypto as a vehicle to do that, that's fine, right? Or for Eric here in New York, where I've been more involved in these conversations, we're the global home of finance, right? And crypto has become a meaningful part of the financial system. We should be very actively working on what are the city policies that can best attract this industry here, because regardless of the price of Solana or Ethereum or Bitcoin or whatever it is, we want the jobs here, right? Like, yes, I understand that conceptually, cryptocurrency is a sovereignless thing, and that's what makes it interesting and cool in a lot of ways. But people are still physical manifestations, right? We're atoms, right? Mm-hmm. And like, we got to be somewhere. And the truth is, as a New Yorker, I want those jobs here. And so Eric showing the industry, like, hey, I care, I'm interested, how can I work with you? I think was a really important step, especially in an ambitious city politics weeds here. But his predecessor, Bill de Blasio, who was so hostile to tech and so hostile to business, you know, carried a flip phone to make the point that he didn't like or believe in technology, that the message being sent to startups and funds were like, get the fuck out of here, we don't want you, right? Which was very frustrating for me, because we spent the Bloomberg administration, you know, I was Mike's campaign manager, 12 years doing the opposite. And Mike is a tech entrepreneur, right? And he worked incredibly hard to build the sector in New York because he wanted to diversify the economy. We saw 8 years of de Blasio sort of tearing it down. And so Eric, just in extending that message, even by taking the first three paychecks in Bitcoin, it said a lot to the tech community, the VC community broadly, that I think was really important, regardless of whether that paycheck now is 50% of what he would have gotten if taken in cash or 200% or anything else.
Okay, so then the more personified manifestation of this then is like the SBF dynamic. A bunch of candidates, institutions, political operations took a bunch of SBF money. I'm not alleging anything corrupt, gave a lot of money to a lot of people. That's kind of like the strategy. But how would you, like putting on your campaign advisor hat, suggest that candidates and organizations just think about this, right? Because if you'd sat down with either the candidates or Vox, like the people who took money for like their Future Tense project, they couldn't have like articulated or even like unpacked whatever FTX was doing. They just know there's this guy and he has money and he seems smart. So how should people handle that, especially as crypto wealth goes up in general? How should people think about that?
So I think as we're looking, if you look at the SBF indictment specifically, from what I can tell, there's sort of two categories, right? There's financial fraud, and then there's sort of political corruption, right? So I think if you are a member of the House or whatever it is, and some crypto guy wanted to donate to your campaign or wanted to donate to the DCCC or whatever it is, fine, right? Your job is to raise as much money as you can. You vet people to make sure that they're not, you know, unable to donate because they're foreign residents or whatever it is. But beyond that, you know, basically you take the money, right? That's a big part of your job. So I don't blame whether it's Fox or, you know, any candidate or anything else. The second half, though, which is straw donors, right? And actively manipulating campaign finance.
Can you explain what those are, straw donors?
So if I want to raise money for a candidate, and let's just keep it the House to make it simple, I can give $2,900 for the primary and $2,900 for the general election. So let's say Congressman X comes to me and says, can you raise me $50,000, right? For me, it is actually a hell of a lot easier to write a check for $50,000 than it is to go ask all these people for money, right? Because if I ask people for money, A, it takes up my time. My time is valuable. B, there's no such thing as a free lunch, which means that all those people are then one day going to come back to me on something, whether it's a candidate they like or their kid needs a letter to get preschool, whatever the fuck it is, right? I'm going to have to do something, right? It's a lot easier and cheaper for me to write the check. So if I were engaging in straw donors, I would say to you, Marshall, I'm going to send you $5,800 in Venmo or crypto, whatever it is, and you do me a favor. And then, you know, you didn't really give money, so your ability to request something of me is significantly lower, right? Because you'd actually have to do it. So people do that because they're trying to get around campaign finance laws. That's very early, right? And it seems like SBF did it both with the people who lived in that crazy real world house of his, right? And they were doing it, and with people in the political consulting business itself, there are going to be a lot of subpoenas, you know, in that part of my world. And I think most of them will be fine because it'll be, you know, people who had some interaction, but there was nothing specifically illegal proposed. And, you know, they'll have to test a bio or at least go into the, you know, attorney's office and explain what it was. And there will be some people who very actively did engage in corruption. They should and will go to jail. And look, SBF is fucked, right? Because all of his top people already flipped up, right? So mm-hmm. he has no incentive at the end of the day, despite what everybody's saying right now, not to cooperate as much as he can to bring down his sentence, right? Because it seems to me that if Elizabeth Holmes got 11 years, if I'm the U.S. attorney in New York, I'm like, well, I got to beat that, right? And the truth is, what SBF did is probably much worse than what Elizabeth Holmes did, right? So as a result, I think you're looking at 20 plus years. I think his parents are looking to jail. I think there's a lot there. So the logical thing for SBF become once he sort of accepts this new reality that he's in is, okay, how do I negotiate this down as much as possible? Get my parents off the hook. Maybe I get 12 years if I'm 24. And he's going to give all these people up, right? And I don't know how they survive. So I think you will see people go to jail. You will see careers ending. And look, I do know people who were approached by various types of independent campaigns that were funded by him, that were so cryptic and vague as to where the money was coming from and so unwilling to disclose it, that they said, you know what, this is too sketchy for me.
And these are candidates.
But these would be typically independent expenditure. So an independent expenditure is, you're running for office, I donate my $1,500 to you, you use that as you see fit. But let's say, rather than me raising you $50,000, I say, you know what, I can just write a check for $50,000 to this PAC supporting Marshall for Congress, and they can spend it on whatever they want. That's fine, but you know, there is disclosure of who the donors are to PACs. Again, if they're hiding it through all these different layers, that's a problem. And that I know firsthand that was definitely happening.
So the takeaway basically is that at the end of the day, there's only so much you can do as a candidate. So you should probably just not do, once again, it's one thing to get money from somebody. It's another thing to, let's say, then compromise your values or do something you wouldn't do. Like, that's probably the thing you have control over.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think at the end of the day, I think generally speaking, he was the one to be taken for a ride by the politicians, not the other way around.
Interesting.
Right? The political sector is brilliant at exploiting people who are really rich and really unsophisticated, but think that they know a lot. Sam Bankman-Fried, the problem with the political, he didn't know what he didn't know. In fact, that's usually the problem for him on everything, right? But certainly politically. And so I think they were all just milking the guy. Like a VC who I work with, or she sent me an email when it was all blowing up saying, despite all of this, I want to have the kind of influence that he did. How do I do that? And I said, well, he just stole a bunch of money and then gave it to candidates and IEs, right? He didn't do anything. He didn't develop policy proposals, actually went anywhere. He wasn't able to influence actual legislation in a meaningful way or regulation in a meaningful way. He just gave them, they told him how great he was. He gave them his money and they used him just like they use everyone. And so, you know, the one thing maybe not to do is look, if you truly don't understand a sector, and most people in government don't understand crypto, 99.9% crypto, it's one thing to take his money. If you're going to do something publicly that he needs, you have to vet it a little more, because it's not like a housing thing or healthcare. It's something that you do all day that you can kind of accurately assess the pros and cons and the risks and the benefits of things.
You know, this brings to mind a recent episode you did. So you were discussing how you've largely given up engaging at the federal donor level, gridlock problems. It's actually much more effective to engage state, local, city. When you're bringing up SBF being taken from a ride, tell us about this space then, right? Because it seemed as if SBF thought that if he donated X amount of money, legally or illegally, he could have influence over the system. You're suggesting that even if he had not been caught, you're skeptical of the amount of actual thing you're going to be able to do.
It only works if the politicians believe, and this is true at any level of government, that you are going to be a sustained presence, right? So if you come in for one cycle, you show this, for example, a lot in the charter school movement with the hedge fund guys, right? I worked with them. Most of them really genuinely want to try to do some good and to help kids. And I think a lot of charter schools are fantastic. I'm a big believer in them. But the skepticism that I got from politicians that wasn't unwarranted is, well, you know, they like this thing right now, out with they'll find some new hobby in 4 years. And if I take on the teachers union, who's going to be there to support me in 4 years, right? And that's a really big problem. Same thing with anything, right? You have to say, I'm going to be here election after election, support you to oppose you, whatever it is, whether you like it or not. And once they accept that you're going to be a factor, then they have to deal with it, right? So you can be the shiny toy. And yeah, look, if they had a stablecoin bill going through, would SBF have had the ability to at least talk to members about it more than, you know, Brian Armstrong or someone else? Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But overall, it's being that kind of sustained political presence, which really also means understanding how elections work in the first place, right? So we live in a world where 99% of districts, and again, this is true in municipal government, state government, federal government, are gerrymandered, right? Which means the only election that actually matters most of the time is the primary, right? And primary throughout this country, putting the presidential aside, is typically about 10 to 15%, right? And so what all you're really doing, unless you're changing the system, which is what I'm trying to do with local voting, but putting that aside, you have to say to the elected official, I can move that 10 to 15%. I can either influence them negatively against you, I can get them positively inclined towards you, or I can bring in another 5% from somewhere else that normally doesn't vote, but I can make this happen, and that's going to screw you up, right? So for example, we legalized FanDuel, portfolio company of ours, first company ever made. I remember meeting with politicians in different places and saying, look,
and this is sports betting, right?
Yeah, sports betting. Well, this was actually, yeah, this was daily fantasy sports betting, yeah. Meeting with them and saying, listen, you have 9,000 DraftKings or FanDuel customers in your district. Let's be honest. They don't know who you are. They don't even know where a state rep is, let alone, you know, who you are. But they fucking love this thing. And right now, they never bother you. They don't ask you for anything. They'll win your primary if they effectively don't exist in your world. If you take this away from them, they're going to be pissed and they're going to be motivated. I'm going to make sure they don't. And that was enough to basically legalize. We won everywhere, right? And the reason why is every single policy output is driven by a political input. Every single decision made by every single politician, with one or two examples like Mike Bloomberg, is how will this affect my next election? And if you can show them that you can either help them win re-election or you can potentially cost them re-election, they will work with you and do what you want. If you can't impact that, you're completely out.
So obviously, you have a degree of bias for Mike Bloomberg on a couple of different levels, yeah. But I'd love from a model perspective then to talk about why you're saying like Mike Bloomberg is one of the people who wasn't operating on that level.
Sure. Let me just to establish with the audience a little bit of credibility. I've worked in city government, both in Philadelphia and New York. I've worked at agencies and City Hall. I've worked in state government. I was deputy governor of Illinois. I worked in federal government. I was Trump Chief Communications Director. Executive branch, the legislative branch, I work campaigns, I'm technically a lawyer. I feel like I've really seen this from every conceivable angle. And Mike was one of the very, very few people I ever met that just didn't make decisions based on that criteria of re-election. In fact, if you told him this would be good for the next election, he would get angry at you and it would actually make it less likely that he would do it. And by the way, as his campaign manager, really fucking frustrated, right? Because my life would have been a lot easier if we could have been more traditional in some ways and said, like, okay, so-and-so, like, you know, yeah, you care about this and you matter in the elections. We're going to try to work with you. If Mike didn't believe that what they wanted was right, it didn't matter how powerful they were. He just didn't do it. Now, that's great. It's what we should want in our politicians for sure. Not what the campaign manager necessarily wants. But, you know, look, in fairness to the other 99.5% or whatever it is, Mike came into office already a billionaire, already a CEO. He was 60 when he took the mayoralty. And so, you know, he was a grown man who didn't need the job, was wildly successful, but accomplished so much already that he had a completely different mentality than everyone else. Most people go into politics, this is the best job they're ever going to have, right? If you accept that 99% of politicians are desperately self-loathing, insecure people that can't live out the validation of holding office, it fills a hole in their psyche. And any individual policy is not as important as filling that hole. So let's give an example from each side. You're a Republican congressman from Florida. This was a gerrymandered turnout, 12% in your primary, and NRA members make up half that 12%. You may understand intellectually that it's fucking crazy that someone can walk into a store and walk out with an AK-47 20 minutes later. But you know what? For as long as 50% of your vote share is NRA members, you're never going to vote for an assault weapon ban. Because for you, losing your seat is a lot worse than a school shooting, a Walmart shooting, a church shooting. You wouldn't admit that publicly, but clearly you feel that way. If you didn't, you would pass this bill, right? Or on the left, New York, Amazon wanted to set up their second headquarters in Queens. And it was great for the city. The city as a whole wanted it. The district as a whole wanted it. Poland clearly showed that. 25,000 direct jobs, tens of thousands more indirect jobs. But the state senator, Mike Gennaris, who was really, really powerful, who's number two state senator at the time, still is actually, he understood his voters really well. And he knew that, you know, the 9% turnout in his primary were people who fucking hate Jeff Bezos, they hate Amazon, they hate Binge, they hate that. And if he were to support it, he would be punished by them, not reward. I remember when the politicians who started opposing you did so almost said, well, you're all going to lose your next election. And I wrote my next column for the Daily News saying, no, they're not. They're doing this because they want to win their next election. And by the way, the council member, this congressperson, the state senator, the state rep, they all got reelected with well over 70% of the vote because they read the electorate correct. The problem is with these very, very narrow groups, the only ones who are relevant to keeping these people in office, which means keeping them from hating themselves and keeping them from like feeling like a failure. These people generally are not, they don't have the talent to go into some other industry and make lots of money, right? So they call all the shots, as we're seeing just wrapping this back onto our first question. The speaker's race right now. So mobile voting, which I've been funding and running the campaign on nationally, which it means vote on your phone securely so that we can get primary turnout from 12% to 30%, simply because as engaged as much as they might say they care, I would bet just about everybody listening to this podcast right now, they found voting in every city council primary, every state rep primary, everything else, because it's a pain in the ass. You got to go somewhere on a random Tuesday and be late to work or not get to school, whatever it is. If you could press a few buttons on your phone, you wouldn't definitely do it, but your odds of doing it would go way up. The reason we beat taxing legalized Uber is because we were able to mobilize our customer base. And over a couple of year period, several million people emailed, called, texted, tweeted in some way through our app, told politicians, I want this thing. And that was enough to win in every single market. So what that said to me is it's not that people are too apathetic to ever do anything. They're too apathetic to show up in person for an election that doesn't seem that important, right? So would all of them vote on their phone if they could? No. But again, if we went from 12% to 30%, what that would mean is the underlying base of voters becomes much more mainstream as a result, because the higher the number goes, the more we get towards the mainstream. And that changes the underlying incentives for the politician, which makes it a lot easier to do compromise, to support consensus, to try to get stuff done, because you're not as vulnerable in the primary from the far left and far right, because the turnout is a lot higher. So we have funded elections in 7 states, 21 jurisdictions so far. People have been able to vote on their phones in real elections, basically deployed military people with disabilities. We have for the last year and change now been building our own mobile voting technology that I have funded and my foundation personally, that we will release hopefully in Q2 of this year. And it will be completely free and open sourced, and it will be the most secure election technology ever built, if nothing else, because it'll be the most recent, because I spent $10 million on that money building it. And so my hope is that once this technology is out there, I don't think anyone would have paid to build it. Government wouldn't do it because they don't want to change the status quo, because they know how they have power now. And the election companies can't do it because, one, they don't have $10 million to invest in this thing. Two, you know, they don't build products unless there's a clear demand for it by the election officials, right? So it requires someone like us to come along and do this. So my hope is once we can prove it's at least as safe as paper ballots and voting machines, we can start building a movement for it. Anyone who's interested in this, you go to mobilevoting.org. There's tons of good phone calls.
Yeah, and we discussed the mobile voting at a higher level or kind of a more like nuanced level on your first appearance, so folks should check that out. We discussed the security stuff a bit. I want to focus on the part of the picture I'm really interested in, which is the trust issue. So key theme of this show, especially the past few years, has been that America and, you know, Western societies in general are becoming more low trust, 2010s, post-financial crisis, the 2020s. I'm curious, do you think it would have been easier? Let's put aside, once again, the security and the technology aspect. I'm sure it's easier now to use the internet to do this than it was in the 90s. Do you think it would have been easier to pass these reforms when the U.S. was at a higher trust level? And if that is true, how do you navigate the political aspect?
Great, great question. I'm going to take it apart from a few different pieces, right? So the first question would be, let's use the 90s. As the contrast here, would it be easier or harder for us to build this movement, right? So on one hand, politics was easier because you didn't have social media. You didn't really have 24-hour cable networks. You didn't have this entire world of constant chaos, polarization, Donald Trump. You didn't have any of that. So getting anything done was definitely easier than it is today. On the flip side, even in 1993, every politician in office would still say to themselves, well, I figured out how to win in these low turnout primaries. Managed to make it easier for someone to come along and challenge me because now all of a sudden the voter base is a lot bigger. So politicians are always protecting themselves at all costs at any point in history, right? And so maybe the argument is we're only going to win this thing because of social, right? I need an Arab Spring to happen in this country effectively where enough millennials, enough Gen Z voters say, fuck this, we know it's safe and we refuse to let you prevent us from using it just because it's not in your personal interest. That's the way this is going to happen, right? Because I got to pass bills in all 50 states. The entire institution, Republicans, Democrats, unions, lobbyists, trade groups, they're all going to oppose us, right? Because all of them have figured out how to win in the current system and none of them want to make it hurt, right? And so I don't think I could actually win this fight. And I still might not win it, but I don't think I could win it without social media. So I'd say weirdly, most of the time, if you ask them that question, the answer would be the 90s, right? But in this particular case, I would go with now. But then the other question really is, when did that lack of trust happen? So I would argue that it started with the Vietnam War. And I also argue the birth of cryptocurrency was effectively the Vietnam War, not the white paper of 2009, because it was, you know, the first time that we had a war that was, at least in for modern history, right? I can't speak to the Spanish American War or whatever, but like that was clearly a bad idea.
Oh, you mean, do you mean the Iraq War?
I mean the Vietnam
War. Oh, Vietnam, okay, Vietnam, okay.
My point is, I think this started much earlier.
Okay.
I think when Vietnam came along, it was such an unjust war and such a war that had so many terrible casualties of most people in someone that had died in the war, that that changed it. And trust in government from that moment on never recovered. And then as time went on, that became applied to Wall Street, the church, the media, higher ed. And to your point now, if you look at Pew does really good polling around this, trust in any institution is close to zero. And so what does that mean? It means one, people are not going to participate in the system, so they don't vote. Two, they're going to get to really polarized places because they're angry, right? And they feel like their lives not being taken care of. Shaky. Or three, they're going to look for alternate systems, right? And where alternate system became cryptocurrency, right? So, you know, 2008 was another really big example of trust shattering, right? The banks that were supposed to be kind of keeping the economy afloat ended up sort of basically screwing everything over. And there was no real consequence, right? Yeah, yes, Lehman Brothers went out of business, a couple others got acquired, but no one really went to jail, right? And so when the white paper, you know, by Nakamoto came out the next year, I think at least in part because of the outrage fueled by the fact that there was no accountability for what happened. Right? Just another example of the lack of trust. So with crypto, once blockchain became a thing, right, which wasn't really possible until the last 12, 13 years or so, even conceptually, for people who were really disaffected by the system, they'd say, you know what? Fuck this. I don't trust the government. I don't trust the central banks. They're just going to screw me over. I'd rather throw my lot with other people who I'll never know their names because they're publicly, hidden. But nonetheless, they think the way I think. And so I'm going to buy this thing called Bitcoin instead. Right. And I think that's ultimately that lack of trust that began in Vietnam is what led to cryptocurrency, which means while this current manifestation of crypto may not succeed in all the ways everyone thought it would, it may evolve differently. Some companies may still make it, some may not, whatever else. This notion of people don't trust society, don't trust the system, and there are some people are looking for an alternate mechanism, that's going to stay. Right. And that's why something like crypto survives long term, why other things will happen too. Because I don't see any world for a long time where that trust comes back. Now, look, if my mobile voting thing were to happen and over a 20-year period, there was a lot more done by government because there was a lot more consensus, maybe that would start to rebuild trust. But, you know, that would still be several decades.
Yeah. So one last thing before we get to your to close with your predictions. Let me just reflect back on what you're saying. So when I'm hearing your articulation of the need for, let's say, like an Arab Spring adjacent movement with millennials and Gen Zs. I'm interested in the order of operations here. So think of like the last great era of political reforms, like the progressive era. Women get the right to vote. You end the you institute the direct election of senators. That and once again, this is me just doing AP US history here, not a historian, but that to me seems to be the progressive movement comes yeah. about. There are a series of ideas, and the only way to actually implement those ideas were those bigger sets of changes to society. It right. seems to me that my critique of how you're making the argument for mobile voting and how Andrew Yang articulates the argument for the Forward Party is it's kind of like arguing for the process and the procedures not attached to a specific set of things you want. So I could see a millennial Arab Spring happening if, let's say, like Social Security is about to blow up tomorrow and government has to say, we either favor silence and boomers or we favor millennials. If you were to say, hey, millennials, if you guys don't all vote via this mobile reform, you're going to be financially screwed. I could see that as a catalyst for change.
Yeah.
But I'm just kind of curious about whether the technocratic argument works.
You're on the spot. So I'll give you at least how I'm going now, but that doesn't mean I'm right. One is, I think climate change is that issue, right? Like I have a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old. And they are so motivated by this. They're so convinced that their lives are going to be significantly worse because of the inability to respond to climate change that I think it motivates them in a way that's different. And I think that's true across the board for Gen Z pretty much. You know, so one is, I think that you're right. We have to latch onto an issue because a process solely based campaign can never win. That's probably the one. So that's number one. Number two, you know, we're just trying to kind of lay the groundwork now. So I've got an employee sitting near you in Austin who all he does all day is talk about mobile voting on TikTok. And Instagram and Snap, but mainly TikTok. Because the more that we can educate people now about why this is the right thing to do, the more we will have laid the groundwork. So when that Arab Spring has to come, people will already be familiar with it. So that's number two. Number three is going to be, you know, I'm going to need some really deep-pocketed allies. I have funded the mobile voting effort solely by myself so far. I've done like $15 million total out of my pocket. And I've done well as a VC, but not well enough to fund this thing, definitely. And so I will only succeed if other people who have resources and really want to change the system are willing to come on board with, which is, so once we release the technology, the next thing for me to do is not go pass bills, because I wouldn't be able to pass them yet, is to find allies. Right. Okay. And then the final part would be bringing the concept of mobile voting into mass culture as much as possible. Right. So the movement that I like to look at is the same-sex marriage, right, which was incredibly successful. It moved really fast, I think in part because the world had just changed quite a bit in terms of mm-hmm. technology and everything else. But also, I remember talking to a friend of mine, this would have been like in 1997 or 8. I said, when do you think this will happen? And he said, it's when Queer Eye for the Straight Guy is the number one show. And he was right, meaning it was a cultural change, a social normative change that then produced the political change, right? And ultimately the judicial change, which was still a political decision, but that's wrong, a good one, a political decision. So I think that we've got to get mobile voting into the vernacular as much as possible, you know, work it into TV shows, work it into podcasts, work it into culture however we can, because if people sort of see it that way and they start getting used to it, used to the ideas of it, when it's then time for them to rise up and say, hey, state of Oregon, we're going to do, you know, you have to do this thing, the more that's already in their minds, the easier it's going to be for us to do it. So look, with all that said, I'm still talking about something required up in the entire political status quo in this country, unbelievably hard. On the flip side, and I believe, and I'm sure you believe, never listens to this podcast, believes inherently technology always wins at the end of the day, right? Question is, what's technology and over how long? But ultimately, that's always the victor. And so, well, even if I did nothing, at some point mobile voting will happen, right? Because the world will just evolve in that direction. It might be 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. But my view is every year we don't have it is another year of polarization or another year of dysfunction. And so if I can cut that period from 40 down to 12, I hopefully produce 28 better years. And so that's really what I'm trying to do, is sort of just get us to that place faster than we're having otherwise.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate the point you're making around the order of operations there. Okay, so let's close with just a couple of sectors that you've done a lot of like thinking on, and that I especially have been interested on the show. So one, let's talk about infrastructure, right? Like we could put away our infrastructure week jokes. Bills passed last year. So like, what's your take on infrastructure going into 23?
Yeah, I think it's, look, I think Biden does have three or four things that he can genuinely say, I accomplished this. And I think infrastructure is clearly one of them. And one of the, look, a lot of it is just basic stuff that should happen, actually much greater numbers of repairing bridges and roads and tunnels and, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? That could leave a crumbling infrastructure. But the thing that they did that was really great was they included hundreds of billions of dollars for electric vehicles, for climate tech, for clean tech. And then in the Inflation Reduction Act, which was really ultimately a climate bill that was just called back as Manchin wanted it called back, hundreds of billions more for the sector. So what it means is there's now a lot of money from the federal government. And what's different from before is it was really smart what they did. They guaranteed it over a 10-year period. And the reason why that's important is investors like me, we were literally, Jordan, my partner, and I were having this debate this morning about this of like, you know, Jordan said, what about carbon capture? And, you know, Bob Greenlee, who's our climate expert, said, well, look, here are all the things that you should know about it. And then Jordan's response was, well, seems like 2008, why would we do it? And I said, well, the one thing I think that might be different is 10 years is a pretty long time, right? So for us to make an investment at Seed or A and exit, still it should happen within a 10-year period in that window. So even if the subsidies do eventually run out and these companies do struggle, there's an argument that because of the certainty that Congress provided, people like me can deploy capital because I feel comfortable enough that there's enough time for me to make it through the entire process. And look, the only way we're going to beat climate change ultimately is again, through technology. Humans are completely incapable of changing their behavior in a meaningful way to lower emissions. Like, you know, they came to these conferences to agree on what the number should be, let alone get them to actually do anything about it. So human behavior is never going to change. What's going to change is stuff like carbon capture becomes a reality. And all of a sudden, if you can suck vast amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere, then all of a sudden the 1.5-2 degree difference doesn't mean as much because you've reduced the underlying amount completely. So you're going to need various types of technology, treaties that can absorb more carbon dioxide, whatever it is, to solve this problem. And that some of that will come from government research and money, but some of it will come from private money. And the great thing the government did here is they made it a lot easier for private investors like me to justify it.
And just a quick thing, when you were referencing 2008, like you're referencing how green tech, which was kind of more of the term. Can you just give a quick, like 30-second explainer
Yeah, sure.
of the difference?
Sort of the first kind of real birth of green tech and clean tech, where people said, hey, you know, you can build an entire new sector around, you know, retrofitting buildings, you know, renewable energy, creating, you know, rooftop gardens, whatever it was. People were really excited about that. And it led to a lot of private sector investment, but a lot of losses, right? You know, most notably Kleiner Perkins and John Doerr. He made a huge bet on it and was trying to do the right thing, lost an incredible amount of money. And his reputation never really fully recovered, right? To some extent it did, but I think it was always, you know, he took a hit. Blackstone, right? You know, they had multiple climate funds. They all failed, right? So lots of people invested a lot of money, but ultimately the certainty needed for those projects to come to fruition and for the subsidies to continue until they really became, you know, market-based entrants, wasn't there. And as a result, it failed and it scared off investors quite a bit, right? So even though we've had record amounts of VC investment over the past 5 years, not that much of it comparatively has gone into decline as compared to tech or digital health or whatever else, even though it's probably the one thing that society needs the most. And so, and the difference is in 2008, the idea was there, the excitement was there, but the certainty wasn't necessarily there. Maybe because no one even realized we needed it at that point, right? I mean, this time around, Congress did a really good job, and I rarely couple that Congress. In fact, this morning I was saying to a friend, like, why does it matter if the House is inoperable, right? Other than maybe the debt ceiling vote coming up, like, so what? You know, unless we declare war, like, they don't do any good anyway. Who cares? But in this particular case, they did do good.
And then the other sector I'd love to hear your thoughts on. So two-part question about this. So one, just like transportation. And then two, we'll close on your political perspective of how you think Pete Buttigieg has done. Because I think what's been fascinating is normally, you know, he didn't originally want transportation secretary, but this has been the most relevant that position has been narratively with supply chain crisis, airlines, transportation. So what are your thoughts on the sector? But then two, let's close with your thoughts on his political performance.
So on the sector in terms of transportation tech, I'm definitely a heavy ambassador in that space. Or Uber would have probably done, you know, Clear and Bird and Nexar and 10 others too. From a regulatory standpoint, we are really shitty in that technology on a lot of these things has advanced a decent amount, not as far as, you know, we were hearing level five autonomy by 5 years ago, and I think we're still.
And that's self-driving cars, right?
That's full self-driving cars. But overall, the technology significantly exceeds the permission that companies have to use it by the gun. And the main reason why is things can get done in state. Things can get done in state. Nothing gets done in federal. So for the last 7 years now, we've been waiting for USDOT to promulgate rules on how interstate autonomous vehicle driving will work, right? So the federal government regulates the car itself. The local government regulates the speed limit, the stop sign, whatever else it is. So you need both. And states have actually, cities have moved forward with legislation on. It's like we're investing with Kodiak, which is an autonomous trucking company. They operate successfully in big states, California, Texas, things like that, where, you know, just within this thing itself, you can do a decent amount of work. But most trucking is an interstate, you know, activity. And if you can't legally cross state lines, you're stuck, which means you develop an entire sector is stuck. And so I think we're at this point where, with the one exception of drone regulation, which has been more progressive, most transportation tech regulation has been stalled. And that was true when Elaine Chao was transportation secretary under Trump, and it's been true as under Buttigieg now. And so, look, while about to give Buttigieg, you know, some good marks for how he's sort of appeared on TV and whatever else, in terms of has he meaningfully furthered innovation in the sector? No, he has not. He seems to be just as useless as the rest of them. What he has done that's good is he's positioned himself for a lot politically. So I don't know how much there is there with Buttigieg. If you have to ask me, is he more of a Mike Bloomberg or more of a Kevin McCarthy? I would say he's much more of a Kevin McCarthy. He's another ambitious person, has an impressive resume, who wants power, right? And we'll do what he has to do. So supply chain or all kinds of airline problems, whatever else, give him the ability to be out on TV all the time. And he's exceptionally good at it, right? So he has been able to get a great platform to promote and highlight himself so that when he can run for president again, whether it's if Biden does run 24 or 28 or whatever it is, he's done a good job using his time wisely to make him seem that much more relevant and impressive. But, you know, it's just, he's been an impressive spokesperson. He didn't solve this chain crisis. He just sort of explained it, right? He didn't solve massive airplane cancellations and delays. He just talks good, right? So, like, I would say if you like someone who sort of is really good at talking, people who did as your guy, I would love for him to be someone that also is good at doing. I've yet to see that.
Man, to close here, you're asking, is he more Kevin McCarthy or is he Mike Bloomberg? Well, at least unlike Kevin McCarthy, he's known for being able to speak well. So you really just see how Kevin McCarthy is really just, he's really in a league of his own of like the level he was able to rise to relative to his underlying political or doer abilities is very low.
I was thinking more in terms of motivation principles, but yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So Bradley, this has been really great. It was always awesome to check in with you. I'm sure we'll do it another time. Thank you for joining me on. Oh, actually, by the way, where should anything you want to direct folks to?
Yeah,
a couple we talked about.
Sure. So one is if you like this podcast, I've got a podcast as well called Firewall. It is specifically about usually the intersection of tech and politics. So everything Marshall and I just discussed is what we talk about twice a week. Once a week, I talk about it. Once I interview someone who's relevant in the space. So if you're interested in this, please check out Firewall. I'll now make a shameless pitch, which is if you're in New York City and is either a resident or a tourist, I opened up a bookstore and podcast studio this summer called P&T Knitwear. It's an independent bookstore that loses tons of money, but I love bookstores and thought it was right to do anyway. It was the only podcast studio that we're aware of that's free for anybody to use. Give the event space away to the community. people who stock the shelves have the exact same healthcare as people in my venture capital fund. Meaning, I think I'm doing a good thing here, but I'm losing a shit ton of money. So if you like books, please check us out. We're 18 Orchard Street between Houston and Stanton. And we could use all the help we can get.
Awesome. We'll be checking it out when I'm back in New York next month. Bradley, thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.